A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The Other Hand is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Today we are going to do something really quite special. I have a guest on the podcast today, Professor Edgar Morgenroth, Professor of Economics at DCU Dublin. And he is on the pod today. Extremely grateful to him for agreeing to do this, because I'm sure he's been asked many times by many people to talk about a recent research paper that he wrote with another economics professor, John Fitzgerald of Trinity. This paper is about the costs of Irish unity, and it's incredibly topical, incredibly sensitive. It received widespread publicity. Many different people have featured it in newspaper columns, blog posts. What I'm going to do today, I think, is really exploit the medium of the podcast to its fullest extent, because one of my hobby horses is that one of my beliefs is that the podcast is fast replacing long-form journalism. And with honorable exceptions, many of the mainstream media no longer do the deep dive. And what I want to achieve today is, first of all, to provide a clear, high-level explanation of the issues. Because too often, the debate over Irish unity, its costs, the economics of Irish unity, descends into mind-numbing accounting issues. But mostly, often ends up with people hiding their ideology behind dodgy assumptions. So I want to provide clarity, and this research paper that Professor Morgenroth and I are going to discuss very much does that. But the clarity that perhaps can't be supplied in an 800-word newspaper article. So a proper understanding of what matters in a clear and concise way, so that people, the listeners, can understand the broad thrust of the debate and make their own minds up without having to get entangled in the weeds of public sector finance accounting and indeed that ideology. So in the 30 or so minutes available to us, we can provide that overview. But for many people who are interested in the deep dive, we can do that. We can go into the issues that 90-second radio and TV segments and tweets cannot. A proper conversation between someone like me, who's read the paper, has a bit of an economics background, and I've read in research for this pod a lot of the accompanying literature, and I perhaps immodestly claim to have a little bit of expertise, enough anyway to understand the issues. And in a polite, constructive way, properly interrogate one of the authors of this very important paper. So at the end of the day, what we're trying to do today is an exercise in communication, the wide dissemination, proper dissemination of scientific research that I think is so lacking in a lot of our very polarized political and economic debates. So in the spirit of that wide dissemination and doing something slightly different, I want to start where others haven't gone. And that's because they don't have the time or perhaps the inclination. And to do something different, before we get into the numbers, the very important numbers that are contained in the two professors' calculations, And it's a very simple question that I want to pose to Professor Morgenroth from the get-go. And what lessons, Professor Morgenroth, if any, can we learn from 30 years of German reunification at a high level for what we might expect from the issues that we're going to confront with Irish unification should it occur?
So first of all, thank you for inviting me on. It's a pleasure to be on the podcast, and I totally agree with you. It's often the kind of context in which some research sits, and maybe the other work that has gone before it that feeds into it is sort of ignored and on the day when something is published. And I very much welcome trying to go into this in a little bit more detail, and also the context like German unification, which, funny enough, I started working on back in the day of my undergraduate degree. I actually did a BA thesis on German unification and economic restructuring. Subsequently did a number of research pieces, largely for the European Commission, but also one for one of the new federal states within East Germany and in the Federal Republic of Germany as it is. So what lessons can we learn? There are quite a few. Firstly, and again, I'm unfortunately old enough to remember it very well, German unification came as a bit of a surprise. It happened very, very quickly in the space of a few months, really, when the protest movement in East Germany started and the wall fell. And nobody was prepared for it. And because they weren't prepared for it, I think a range of mistakes were made. Some of them were more economic, and others were more social. We still see very substantial differences between East and West Germany. So a whole range of maps have been produced where you don't put a border on the map, the old border, but you can see in the data that the two parts of Germany are still quite distinct. So integration hasn't completed. This is over 30 years. It's not something, you know, it's not 5-10 years after the event. Over 30 years, and we still haven't got full integration. And some people have done some research on this, and particularly economic research, which would suggest that we're looking at perhaps another 20 or 30 years before there is full integration. So far from being a sort of an immediate kind of integration and an immediate unification, the process seems to take many decades. And that means that any issues also will take many decades to rectify. And as I say, there were some mistakes made of an economic nature. There were certainly higher costs involved in unification. And then there were other things that were more social. You know, East Germany wasn't all bad. They had, for example, excellent childcare system. And that system was essentially destroyed because unification was de facto a hostile takeover from the West. And that's what is how it's perceived by some people in East Germany. And they feel somewhat devalued by the nature in which the unification took place.
Yeah, one of the things that I read in preparing for this pod is the extent to which some East Germans are said to be resentful and still are after West Germans started appearing in top positions in East German public and private sectors, which I hadn't known about before, and that has had other ramifications as well. One of those reports that I read was actually conducted from where I'm sitting in the UK by an outfit called the Resolution Foundation, and I'm going to read you a quote from a report that I found on their website. Here we go. Reunification policies in Germany successfully harmonized infrastructure and took major strides in equalizing living standards. This was only possible because the fiscal response was far-reaching, permanent, and based on an all-party, whatever it takes, consensus. But this report goes on to say there are problems, some of them you have addressed there. And one of the ones that was immediately raised was unaddressed wage differentials, and that those wage differentials have led to 1.7 million people leaving East Germany for the West. And the report goes on, and I'm going to quote again here, absence of democracy building and civil society strengthening policies and the wholesale import of Western institutions and elites without sufficient participation of East German stakeholders has contributed to the high levels of political disenfranchisement in East Germany. Would you agree with that sentiment?
I think there's certainly quite a bit to that that I would agree with. Now, one has to remember the circumstances, and this is also where there are differences with Northern Ireland. You know, when unification happened, we had on the one hand a democratic liberal democracy, and on the other hand we had a communist dictatorship that had collapsed. And in the GDR, positions were filled not just on merit but also on party allegiance and how trustworthy within the party people were. So you typically had senior positions filled by party apparatchiks who were there not necessarily by merit. And let's remember, the GDR regime locked away a lot of dissidents. Political dissent was not allowed. It killed people who were trying to flee from the GDR. We had the building of the Berlin Wall and so on. You know, there was certainly a criminal dimension to that regime, as we would see it. And so it's not surprising that those senior people, it was felt, would have to be removed. I think that was probably done in a way which was not necessarily always fair. So maybe some people in senior positions actually didn't deserve to lose their job and should have maybe stayed. It is also true that a lot of the leading people that came in weren't really recruited from East Germany. They were recruited from West Germany. So within the political system in the federal states, the federal state prime ministers often came from West Germany and rather than being locals. And so you certainly had that sense that it was a sort of a hostile takeover. What's really funny, though, right now is we've had the growth of a far-right party, the AfD, particularly in East Germany, which is actually led by people from West Germany. It's quite ironic that the dissent about this is actually leading to a party which has exactly the same structures that people are dissenting against.
One of the things that emerges from all of that is that one possible stumbling block or the thing to think about that hasn't attracted enough attention is, and this is before we get into the economics, is that East and West Germany involved the merging of distinct legal administration and judicial systems. And as you say, when they did that, a lot of people had to be replaced for fairly obvious reasons. And that's a very complex and potentially very expensive process. And it's expensive not just in terms of money, which we'll come on to, but it's expensive in terms of civil service and politicians' time, energy, and all the rest of it. And Northern Ireland and the Republic do have overlapping systems, but they do also have very distinctive differences. And so there is a merger of two systems going to have to take place. And one assumes that some of those issues that we just touched on are going to take place in the north. And again, I don't think this has been thought about very much, is that what happens if lots of senior people from, say, the civil service start popping up in Northern Ireland, for example, in some new functions? Will some judges from the Republic start appearing in the Northern courts? These sorts of issues, I think, are going to be very live issues going forward. And I think that we should learn some of the lessons that perhaps Germany, some of the pitfalls that they fell into.
Well, that is, I think, the elephant in the room is what is the shape that we would like a united Ireland to take? It seems to me that every party in the Republic of Ireland has at least an aspiration for unification, some more so than others, but nobody has spelled out exactly a vision for what that should look like. And should it be a hostile takeover like we had in Germany, or should it be some kind of blend of systems, or perhaps even something new, in different areas? And as much as you might see officials from the Republic up in Northern Ireland, you might also see some from Northern Ireland down here. So, but we don't really know what anyone wants to do. And this was exactly the problem with the German unification. There wasn't a plan. And when it happened very fast. And a plan had to be cobbled together really, really quickly. And that ultimately was the easiest way to do it, is simply to just say, okay, we'll take whatever we have in West Germany and we will apply just that to East Germany. And that's it. And whatever was East German in terms of the system, we just throw out. And some of that wasn't, wasn't bad. Some of it was actually quite good. So throwing all of that out actually came with a cost, and an additional cost. I think that's the biggest lesson from German unification, is to actually understand the implications of different decisions and having some kind of a plan. You can't plan everything out, but you should have a rough idea where you want to go, at least.
I'm delighted that you've said that, Professor Morgenroth, because it speaks to, I think, the most important lesson to come from Germany, which as you said, is that you must have a plan. And if you're going to have a plan, you're going to have to rely on experts to come up with the plan. Experts like you, quite frankly, if you don't mind me saying, because we've had another lesson more recent in history about what happens when you do big structural changes to your economy without a plan. And you know what I'm referring to. And of course, here in the UK, we are suffering from having introduced a wrenching economic change, not a unification type change, but nevertheless, a very big one. And it's called Brexit. You do something big like that without a plan, and you are guaranteed to get yourself into trouble. And we explicitly, thanks to Michael Gove's famous quote, which is that we've had enough of experts here in the UK, we did it without any expertise. We positively set our faces against expertise. So I'm delighted to see your call, and all I can do is echo it. If I might come to finish off the discussion about Germany before we get into the details of your paper, I just want to, again, take a couple of points from the research that I've read about that to see how it applies to the Irish potential case. And one of the things that struck me was points that have been made about the way West Germany invested in public infrastructure in Germany. And they did a lot of it. And again, I'll quote from one of these reports. Although crucial, public sector infrastructure investment is not enough on its own to drive prosperity gains. Infrastructure in East Germany is now on a par with the West, but productivity and pay are still 20% lower. One of the mistakes, and the key mistake that I've seen some researchers say that was made, is that West Germany, the policy in Germany for the East was the preservation of existing economic structures, and in particular, the preservation of existing jobs. And not enough thought was given to new jobs and new technologies, new industries, innovation. And so the old jobs were preserved, and not enough attention was paid to perhaps new jobs. And one of the thoughts that flowed from that for me about Ireland is that the one thing that the Irish have been very good at, in recent years at least, is the production of new jobs. The Irish miracle economy that we know has lots and lots of new jobs in, is not reliant on old smokestack industries. And that maybe there's some cause for hope there, that the mistake that was made in Germany won't be made when it comes to the Northern Irish economy.
The investment into East Germany has been really staggering, there are regular calculations as to what unification has cost. And
can I interrupt you there, Professor? Because I saw one soundbite, and this is a radio type soundbite that really struck me. That for each and every year since unification, West Germany has spent on East Germany via this mostly infrastructure investment and other initiatives, of course, the equivalent of one pandemic furlough wage subsidy scheme per year, every year. That's the amount of money that is taken.
It's somewhere between 1.5 and 3 trillion euros. It's a staggering amount. So the regular reports on this produced for the German Parliament, for the Bundestag, and one should add, still the majority of Germans are happy with unification. So they're obviously willing to pay that. It's actually a case now that the infrastructure in East Germany is better than the infrastructure in West Germany. Something like 50% of motorway bridges in Germany need to be replaced. But that will not be applying to those in East Germany, which are relatively new. So that it's predominantly a problem of West Germany. From that perspective, East Germany is actually a much better place to invest in. And yet, we still have productivity differences persisting. And that brings me actually to the results of research, again, that I have been involved in ever since my PhD, which happened to be on infrastructure. And that is that infrastructure alone isn't going to do a whole pile for you. You need the people to use it. As you might know, the East Germany lost a lot of population in the immediate wake of unification. People just simply left because they had much better prospects in West Germany, and they didn't come back.
I presume that's not going to be the case with Irish unification, because people clearly in Northern Ireland will come to Ireland today if they want to, and indeed many do. So I think it's unlikely that we'll get that kind of migration.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
That's actually a really interesting area. You have to remember that there are two communities in Northern Ireland, and the nationalist community is different from the unionist community, and unionists may have a different point of view and may actually want to go to GB, as it were. So that there might be some people leaving. It's not at all clear that that wouldn't happen. It could also be the case that people from the Republic who at some point in time came from Northern Ireland would come back. And likewise, there might be people from unionist tradition that might come back to a Northern Ireland in a united Ireland with better prospects. This is very speculative, though. So you can't take anything for granted. It's likely to be different because clearly East Germans, if they had wanted to leave before unification, they were potentially going to be shot. And if they got caught, they were certainly going to be locked up for a while. So we don't have those kind of situations. And this is, again, you know, we need to be careful. East Germany is a particular case. Irish unification will be different. We don't have such drastically different systems, and we don't have those kind of barriers. But there is a potential for some people to leave. It could happen. But currently, if we just assume that the population as it is stays, we see that the Northern Irish population, and there's been research done by others, again, not me, that shows that educational attainment levels, for example, in Northern Ireland are considerably worse than in the Republic of Ireland, and particularly young males, especially in loyalist areas, have quite poor educational outcomes. And that makes them less employable and ultimately less productive. And so educational levels do explain some of the productivity differences between Northern Ireland and the rest of say, southeast of England, and also the rest of Ireland. Those are not going to turn around overnight. And we've seen this in the Republic of Ireland when secondary schools, school attendance became free, which was relatively late, I think it was in the 60s, early 60s. It took a generation before that had actually made a big difference. So whatever about potential, it tends to take a long time to make any real changes. And even when you have vast investment programs and vast regional development programs in East Germany, it wasn't just the infrastructure. The infrastructure was necessary because the infrastructure of East Germany was really, really, really bad. People can't imagine really how bad it was unless they had traveled there before unification or soon after. It really was bad. You know, you've got other kinds of investments going in, other kinds of incentives, and still 30 years later, the issues of productivity differentials persist. And there are other examples. You know, if you think of Italy, southern Italy, their regional development plans have basically 100 years of history now, and we don't see convergence. And that is one of those things that I'm kind of warning about. If you think that somehow or another, within a couple of years of unification, Northern Ireland is going to look like Dublin, chances are it won't be like that, because that's certainly the evidence we have so far.
Sure. Well, everything that we know about regional development globally is that it is very hard. It's only ever successfully achieved by exception rather than the rule. This country, the UK that I'm sitting in today, has been doing something or trying to do something called levelling up for a number of years, which just hasn't happened. A country that I know very well, Wales, has been trying to do it for decades, and it hasn't happened. And what we're learning from our discussion of Germany is that it's not just a matter of money, although money is a necessary, but as we say, not a sufficient condition. And an awful lot of money has been devoted to developing East Germany. Some of it has been very productive, but there are still residual problems 30 plus years later. So let's get into money. Let's get into some of the numbers contained in your very important paper, Professor Morgenroth. Let's start with a layman's discussion or description or definition of that word subvention. Now, my question is really, is it any different to what London taxpayers give to Wales, Scotland, and poorer regions of England? Is it any different to what Dublin taxpayers give to the west of Ireland and border counties, for instance? What is this subvention, which really has attracted most of the publicity around your paper?
So the simple definition is that in a region, certain amount of taxes is collected, and the government spends a certain amount of money. And if there are is less tax collected in that region than is spent, then that region is benefiting from a transfer. It comes from somewhere. In the case of the UK, it's actually the southeast of England and London that pays for most of this. Every country has this to a degree. In the UK, there is actually a formula, the so-called Barnett formula, which governs how much money is transferred between the regions. In the Republic of Ireland, we don't have an explicit formula. There's a little bit of transfer mechanism to local government, which is actually hard to figure out how it works. And the rest works through the tax and expenditure systems. And like other countries, Ireland has transfers. Dublin and the southwest of Ireland, principally Cork, generate a surplus that's distributed to all the other regions. Again, I published a paper on that at some point where, you know, we don't have explicit formulas that distribute the money. So you have to you know, we don't have kind of published numbers as to what goes from A to B. So I had to calculate these, and I did that in a paper some time ago. In the case of UK regions, including Northern Ireland, we actually get very good statistics on those transfers and how much is spent, how much tax is taken. So that's the basic mechanics of what we're talking about. Again, it's worth emphasizing that every country in the world has regional differences, and that means every country in the world has, in some way or another, regional subvention, whether it's explicit or whether it's sort of implicit.
And in the Republic, of course, we do a lot of it, in that the tax and welfare system that you rightly described there does more to reduce inequality than many, many other countries. Certainly within the OECD, the Republic is up there near or at the top of the amount of redistribution.
That's right. And that works between income groups, and it works between regions as well. Because if a particular region is on average poorer, and the tax system benefits the poorer people, then that region gets, on average, a benefit. And you could think of this also in terms of, say, unemployment. You know, if unemployment is higher in one region, the people that are unemployed get unemployment assistance. And if another region, if you just had a country with two regions, the other region didn't have unemployment, well, then obviously there's a transfer going into that region with unemployment. So the tax and welfare systems work in that way of trying to equalize. And so, you know, this is not unusual. We have it in the Republic of Ireland already. And what is unusual, though, is I guess the level of subvention that Northern Ireland receives. So again, some of your listeners might remember during the financial crisis, we talked a lot about Greece and its deficit. Talked about the deficit in Ireland and the way the debt was increasing as well. But Northern Ireland's implied subvention or deficit is actually a multiple, certainly at least twice that of Greece at the worst of times in Greece. So it's quite high. And that has, over the years, been remarked on. It's nothing new. You know, it's something that people were aware of, and indeed the degree to which there were transfers within the UK was subject to number of research articles over the years. What is interesting, though, is that for Northern Ireland, that subvention, if we measure it as a percentage of GDP, has been going up. And there's not really an awful lot of sign that it's going down. So it's heading the wrong direction, and it's large.
And that is mostly, if not entirely, a function of the thing that you mentioned earlier on in the context of East and West Germany that persists to the present day, and that's to do with productivity differentials. Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, is famous for saying that in economics, productivity isn't everything, but it's almost everything. I have a view that he was wrong, that it actually is everything at the end of the day, but that's a separate discussion. And it would be the subject of another podcast to discuss why Northern Ireland's productivity is so low relative to the southeast of England and London. It's not the only region of the economy of the UK that has low productivity. As I've mentioned, Wales and the northeast, but it does seem to have a particular problem. And as we know from going back to our discussion of regional development generally, regional development is about getting regional productivity up at the end of the day. That might be a simplistic way of putting it, but that is a way of putting it. We know how hard it is going to be. So whatever that, we'll get on to the calculation of the subvention in a moment, but whatever it is, whatever the correct number is, and we can argue about that forever, we know that it's large. We know that it takes a Herculean effort to get that productivity differential reduced. Sometimes efforts don't work. They always take a long time. In the case of Germany, we're still working on it over 30 years later. in the UK. We're still working on it, having failed to do very much about it in recent decades. So it's not impossible, but we know that it's going to be both very hard, very long, and very expensive. Is that a fair summary so far?
I think so, yes. I would agree with that. No magic bullet, and you're really looking over decades rather than a few years. And that then means that any costs that are associated accumulate over time. So that's I think, a fair summary.
So one of the things that I used to say, I lived in Ireland for 30 years, and I'm delighted to have met somebody from overseas that's lived even longer than me. You've lived there for 40 years, you told me before we came on air. I always used to say because I lived through in Ireland through a lot of the troubles and grew up in the UK when I was a child when they were raging. And I often looked at these sorts of calculations of how much Northern Ireland costs the British taxpayer, putting it crudely, and wondered why Republicans, instead of carry on with the campaign that they were at the time during the Troubles, didn't simply put full page adverts in the Daily Mail and the other tabloid newspapers in the UK explaining to the British taxpayer that if they left Ireland, they could take 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 pence off the basic rate of tax. But having read your paper, I now realize how naive that sentiment was, because if you were a Republican taking out those adverts, pointing out to the British taxpayer how much money they could save, you are explicitly pointing out to the taxpayer in the Republic just how much it's going to cost them. And so that brings us to the controversy over these sorts of calculations, because of course that they are controversial because they involve certain assumptions. So let's parameterize it a bit. I think that you say that the subvention currently, it's difficult to estimate it from recent data because that's so heavily distorted by pandemic-related payments, which, of course, if not come to an end, they're ending very soon. But about 12 billion sterling a year, is that right?
Yes, that's sort of roughly the magnitude. And again, one has to be always careful. If I was sitting in London and looking at the subvention, I would look at it differently to someone sitting in Dublin, because unification in itself would change some of this, right? And those are sort of adjustments that you would have to make. There's some obvious adjustments you'd have to make to get the magnitude roughly right. And again, we don't have to be exactly right to assess potential implications. If you're within a ballpark, you can see whether there is an issue there or not. And I guess that's sort of what we're trying to do. Obviously, we have very precise numbers in our tables. But you know, you can make slightly different assumptions and change them very slightly. You know, the ballpark remains the same, and I think that's the important.
That's very important, yes. And I think that's the message in that spirit of communicating scientific results, is that what we're trying to establish are ballpark estimates rather than things that are unnecessarily precise, and focusing on one number is perhaps to mistake the wood for the trees. The other calculation that attracted a lot of publicity in the wake of your report was that you said that over time that figure for after post reunification, should it happen, could rise to as much as 20 billion a year for a number of years. Is that a correct interpretation?
That's right. So again, that depends very much on assumptions used. But 20 billion is one number that comes out under certain circumstances. So the first thing to note is that there are wage differences in between Northern Ireland and the Republic, and there are also differences in payment levels on social welfare. And so, the immediate question is, if you had a united Ireland, would these payment levels in Northern Ireland be the same as they are now, or the same as they are in the Republic of Ireland? And that makes a very large difference to the calculations, because the difference is not small. And so, that's how you get to the 20 billion, is if you make all the adjustments.
So you're talking there essentially about things like public sector wages and social welfare benefits, that if you raised the wages of civil servants and public sector workers generally in Northern Ireland and unemployment and other benefits to Republic levels, you're looking at in the ballpark of large numbers.
Yeah, and if you don't adjust them, you're actually looking at roughly half that number. So you can see how big a difference that assumption makes.
So it's huge. So that is a key, if not the key assumption, in terms of the driver of the magnitude of the number, is the extent to which pay and welfare rates are equalized in the two jurisdictions, and of course the time period over which that would happen. I suppose one possible riposte to that, which was to say, okay, it's not going to be 20 billion, we're not going to use your assumptions, Professor, we're going to say that Northern Ireland wage and welfare levels will stay exactly as they are for the foreseeable future, so the cost will only be 10 billion. And I use that word only advisedly. And the sense I get from your paper is that you think it extremely unlikely that that's tenable, that to keep wage and welfare rates in the North as they are post-reunification for very long.
So, I'm an economist, so I'm trained to do these numbers. I'm not a politician. But I would have thought, or I would think, that it would be extremely difficult to explain to someone in Newry why his social welfare benefit is going to be lower than someone in Dundalk, just south of the border, post-unification. It would be very difficult for a politician to explain that to someone and not end up with huge disgruntlement and political pressure because of it. Now, in East Germany, that was actually done. So, for example, pension rates only converged last year. They only were brought up to the level of West German pensions last year. So, you're looking at 30 years of convergence. But I would struggle to see how you could persuade people in the United Ireland that those rates should be different. And again, civil servants, you would have the same thing. I think politically it would be difficult to say they should stay different.
Well, that would be one way of making sure that civil servants weren't planted into all the plum jobs in Northern Ireland, is to keep their wages lower in Northern Ireland, of course.
But maybe. As you say,
yeah, this is going to be a political question. And that, of course, raises all sorts of other political questions. And essentially, I think, which you mention explicitly in your paper, which is that at the end of the day, these and other issues, and I'll come on to a critical one that we haven't mentioned in a moment, are going to be a matter of negotiation between politicians. And one of the things in your paper that really struck home to me was that negotiation is all about relative power and relative starting positions, and that these negotiations, if and when they take place, are most likely only to take place after there has been a referendum, North and South, that agrees to reunification. So that will commit the Republic of Ireland to reunification, and therefore will be going into these negotiations with the United Kingdom government, GB government, if you like, with a very weakened hand, because it's something they have to do. So they're going to have to, in a sense, accept the terms that the British insist on. So the negotiating position of the British will be much stronger than that of the Irish, which will affect those discussions over pensions and welfare payments, but will also, I think, affect the discussion, that negotiation about the share of Britain's national debt that the unified Irish government will have to take on. And I know that a lot of people think that the calculations that you have done, saying that Ireland will have to take on its share of British debt, will be just a matter of negotiation. And I've seen one extreme version of this, is that I've seen Sinn Féin's views on this described as you give us the north, but leave your wallet behind, which is one very lurid way of putting it. And sometimes it's not put as, even as politely as that. But you cite in the paper precedent going back to the breakup of Virginia, a state in the United States in the 1860s, breakup of the USSR, breakup of Czechoslovakia, the potential position of Scotland with relation to UK debt. And in every single one of those instances, the precedent has been established that the country moving on, in whatever way it did, either did take a share of the debt, or in the case of Scotland, was it going to take a share of the debt? And of course, the Irish themselves did it in 1922, which you say in your paper. So I think the idea that Britain will take on board all of the debts that are implicit for Northern Ireland is quite fanciful. And I sense that you think that as well.
So it's, again, as you say, these matters are going to be subject to negotiations with the UK. What won't be subject to negotiations with the UK is what ends up within United Ireland. So those pay rates and those welfare rates, they're actually open to, you know, they don't need to be negotiated. The debt and pensions are issues because on the pension side, people in Northern Ireland have been paying into, you know, they have been paying de facto for their pension to the UK exchequer. And so consequently, you would expect them to have a kind of a claim on their pension from the UK. In the case of the debt, people in Northern Ireland de facto have contributed to the UK's national debt. The thing for the UK in negotiations around the debt is that the individuals, the people in Northern Ireland, don't have a contract with the United Kingdom about paying back that debt. So there's no contract there. And, you know, you could easily say, well, we're not going to be paying this debt. That's it. But then I think you would get into a situation where the UK, say on the state pension, which is paid out of current receipts, would say, well, sorry, lads, but you're not going to get your pension from us in that case. So those are the sort of the starting positions on any negotiations. And where you end up is going to be a little bit difficult to predict. Again, there's a sort of benign view that somehow or another the UK taxpayer is going to pick up parts of the subvention and pensions and the debt as a goodwill gesture, parting present or whatever you might want to call it. But if you get the situation where the UK exchequer is already under serious pressure because the UK economy is underperforming, I would think that a chancellor would try every possible thing to try not to pay. And so it's really difficult to predict what might happen. And that's why we actually in our calculations basically put those options with or without on the table. Now, again, you can argue what the exact number is, but under the circumstance where we would have to pay for the debt and not get pensions out of the UK, again, you're adding extra costs. And really what we're trying to point to is don't take anything for granted. And you know, you plan for the worst and you hope for the best. And I think those sort of calculations just simply need to be on the table. And again, you can disagree with a particular position. You know, maybe it's not going to be the worst at all. Maybe we're going to get somewhere into the middle. Well, the calculations we have allow you to basically make a stab at what that would look like too.
So one of the other conclusions that I would draw from that is that people in the Republic, the government of the Republic, should be being sent to the world's leading business schools for an intensive course on negotiation skills very soon.
If you mentioned Brexit earlier, and I did quite a lot of work on Brexit, and I have this terrible sense of deja vu in terms of a potential referendum here without any detail. But in the Brexit negotiations, Ireland played its hand quite well and was very prepared.
Unlike
the UK, and indeed, I was on calls with senior UK people and with others here in Ireland, and we were just shaking our heads all the time how unprepared the UK was. I published a paper together with others in 2015. I started working on Brexit in 2013. We were well prepared. We knew where the issues were. And Ireland negotiated and informed the negotiation of the EU side very significantly. They were very prepared. Unfortunately, that's not where we are with a potential United Ireland at this point.
But it's something we should presumably start.
This is what we're trying to do with our papers, is contribute to getting to a level of preparedness. And you can't prepare unless you know what you might be facing. So that's exactly where this paper sits.
Well, Professor Morgenroth, I've taken far more time than I promised you that I would. So first of all, let me say thank you for all of that. We could, as I'm sure you're aware, go on for much, much longer. And hopefully we will return to this on many an occasion going forward, because it sounds like a lot of people are going to have to be doing an awful lot of work. But the conclusion that I've reached is that preparation is vital. Expertise is essential. Planning, you're going to repeat the mistakes of Brexit if you don't do an awful lot of planning. And that presumably, even if this event that we're talking about is many years in the future, people should be getting ready for it now, at least in terms of that scoping and planning exercise that we have described being so absent from the Brexit process on the UK side, at least. So thank you very, very much, Professor Morgenroth, for that incredibly insightful discussion. I know that our many thousands of listeners will appreciate it, and hopefully we'll have you back really soon.
Very good. Thank you very much. And one final word is the costs, and there are more costs than even.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
We think of in the paper, one thing, whether it's worth it is a completely different thing. So that is an important thing to remember.
And certainly a topic for another day. Thank you very much, Professor.